even without the concerns raised by Islamic State, there has been a mass shooting somewhere in the United States practically every week this year. Is this simply the way it's going to be now?
Well, we can't tolerate it. There are some steps we can take. One is, and this seems to be something that we should have done. We actually did it. In the 1990s, we voted to prevent the sale of assault weapons. These are very attractive to people who are intent on these military style operations like we saw in Fortune San Bernardino, but that was essentially repealed under the Bush administration. I think we have to do more in background checks. We're trying to get included in background checks people who are on our terrorist watch list. They right now, there's no legal disbarment to buy a weapon in the United States if that's the issue.
You point out how Congress voted very recently on this issue of whether people who are on terrorist watch lists should be barred from buying guns in the U.S. If Congress is at a point after all these mass shootings this year where it's not willing to support even a measure like that, which would seem to have bipartisan appeal, doesn't that suggest the outlook is very bleak?
Well, whether it's bleak or not, we have to continue the effort because this is a practical way to limit the impact, not to probably to eliminate them, but to limit the impact posed by some of these weapons. That's one aspect of this. The other aspect, and there is a mental health component here, access to mental health. There's a community policing aspect to this, to be able to have police who are able to be in the community, have a sense of what's happening, and also be able to react appropriately with the right sort of tactical and technical and hopefully intervene before there's an incident such like as we've seen.
Are the local forces in the countries where ISIL is operating, including Iraq and Syria, up to the challenge of defeating ISIL?
They are making progress, but I don't think I would say right now that they are able to, across the board, sort of rapidly degrade and destroy. That's the objective, but it's going to take some time. There are variable forces here. When you talk about the Kurdish Peshmerga in northern Iraq, they are very competent fighters, very skilled. They've already ejected ISIL from Sinjar, a town in northern Iraq. When you get over into Syria, some of the Syrian Kurdish forces are very effective. They've been fighting very well. Some of the Arab forces in Syria have been very effective. It's a mixed bag. In Iraq, where there's an Iraq National Army, that army was very disappointing when it came about to the fall of Mosul more than a year ago. They simply disintegrated. So there is an effort now to help them reconstitute their forces. One of the tests on the near horizon is the recapture of the town of Ramadi, where now it's been isolated by Iraqi National Security Forces. The next step is going in and pushing out ISIL, taking it back, and then moving forward to the next objective.
The effectiveness of the local forces raises the question of what level of U.S. forces might be necessary to help defeat ISIS, and more U.S. commandos are being dispatched to participate in that fight. So what is your view on how large a U.S. force will be necessary to defeat ISIS?
It's not just a question of defeating ISIS. There's a more fundamental question of holding the ground once you've taken it. And it all leads back to the indigenous forces, local forces on the ground. We can provide assistance. We can provide some training. We can provide some specialized activities, targeting, intelligence. But the boots on the ground, the real boots, the predominant boots, have to be local boots, not just because they're better at it. I think they can be better at it. But also, we have to have a situation where there's not just the taking the ground, but holding it. So I conceive of our actions as one with special forces, limited numbers, and with trainers who are helping these forces maintain and obtain an edge over ISIL.
Beyond the military fight, what do you see as being crucial? What other elements of the fight in a non-military sense are necessary to defeating ISIL?
There's multiple things. First of all, ISIL has been proven extremely effective in their information warfare, in their information campaigns. So the use of social media, the use of sophisticated ways to communicate their message, not only to their own adherents, but to a broader world audience, to attract young men particularly to come in. that has to be disruptive, and we have to be much more effective in countering their information with more appropriate, better information. We have to do that not on just the United States, but our allies in the region, sending out much more effective messages to counter ISIL. Then I think the political dynamic is that, you know, we've got to get a coherent political response for all of our allies in the region and worldwide to be able to counter the ISIL threat. Those are the two of the major sort of non-traditional military challenges.
And you mentioned how ISIL tries to reach out through social media to win converts in other parts of the world. Does the U.S. have an effective response to that? And if not, what would it take to create an effective response?
Well, I think one is that we have been, first of all, I think, frankly, surprised at how capable they are. We assume that social media, hashtags, and all those things are something that is a product of, you know, American or Western technology. And here you have this group of medieval and barbaric dimensions sort of using social media so very adroitly. So we have to, I think, of consciously not only think of ways to do this, but also have the resource to do this. That's one area where I think we're trying, frankly, to catch up. And we've got to not only catch up, we've got to go beyond. And the message has to be in not our voice, because that just, in a way, reinforces the notion ISIL is trying to present to the world that we're somehow trying to suppress Islam. And we have to have a voice from the Muslim community that's effective. One of the things that I think we have to do more of, and that, again, we cannot do it alone, we have to do it in colleague, is in some collegial activity, is to have the voice of Muslim religious figures in the region speaking out against ISIL, appropriately so. And that has to be done with the cooperation, the help of the Saudis, the Qataris, all of these nation states together with their leadership.
To switch gears a little bit, do you expect Donald Trump will be the Republican presidential nominee?
I don't know, honestly. I'd like to assume I know these things. I am, like a lot of people, surprised that he, in a way, that he's captured so much attention. If you think about it, though, he spent a lifetime branding himself. He's got great exposure to the American public. And I think he is generally taking advantage of some of the anxieties that are running throughout the country. I know it's a long way till the convention in June or in July. And a lot of things could happen. So I don't assume he's going to be the candidate. I don't, you know, at this point, he could be. That's something I think 6 months ago most people would say, no, it wouldn't happen. But he certainly could be.
Do you believe the U.S. and other industrialized nations will take the necessary steps in the necessary time to curb the threat of climate change?
Well, the clock has been ticking for a long time. So the question really is not getting ahead of it, but just, you know, we've got to do a lot, and we've got to do it very quickly. In most other countries, we've seen some remarkable progress. In fact, in some cases, there's more momentum around the globe than in the United States, because we have some of my colleagues, particularly on the Republican side of the aisle, who are trying to cut down some of the regulations that we put in place that would hopefully stem some of the pollution that's causing climate change. You've got countries like China who seem to be stepping up to the plate, and I know 10 years ago they were the ones who were claiming they couldn't do anything because they were a developing country. You've got India now, which is trying to switch from hydrocarbons to other forms of alternate energy, solar, that are less environmentally challenging. So there's great momentum worldwide. I think the Conference of Paris shows that.
Senator Jack Reed, thank you for sitting down with us.
Thank you, Ian.